heart and soul of the game of baseball, and that is opportunity and teamwork. And before you can have teamwork, you have to have trust. And all of the human qualities that we want to see in the people of our country are demanded by the game of baseball. And when they're fulfilled, they're recognized, and the ultimate reward on the team, within the team, and forever in life is respect.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
We are broadcasting live from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, and you're exactly where you're supposed to be, coaches. Dial back into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, and guess what? Another certified audio gold episode on the slate for you today. Now, here's the disclaimer right from the start. You should find a quiet spot somewhere, remove any distractions from the room, keep that paper and pen close by, and turn that clock around. We need you to lock into the outstanding reflections and wisdom coming through your speakers with today's show, so just wait. But first, helping us bring our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast to you are our great friends over at AstroTurf. We really appreciate these folks. They are the experts. They are the leaders in the clubhouse for the turf industry for almost 50 years. Just very impressive what they've done. You can find AstroTurf fields at over 200 facilities around the country. So coaches, if you're thinking about changing the game at your facility, make your first call to the great people over at AstroTurf. See how they can help take your field to brand new levels. Now, my thought is that it would be impossible to coach baseball across any level around this country and not know today's guest. We're talking to the winningest coach in college baseball history with 1,975 wins, 15 trips to the World Series over his career, becoming the first coach to ever win 5 national championships over 4 different decades. I mean, really think about that one for just a second. We're talking to the legend himself, Augie Garrido. Now, this is such a dynamite episode, an obvious bucket list for me personally, but I'm more excited to share this with all of our coaches, players, parents, any and everybody who truly loves this game as we sit down and reflect with one of the very best teachers, but also stewards of our great game in Coach Garrido. You'll be floored at the deep revelations, the true introspective view that we take throughout the show, walking with Augie throughout his storied career in baseball. We work to cover all aspects as we dive into his foundation for the mental side of our game, his call for leadership by our coaches, plus Augie details his thoughts on winning and learning, treating each day as an opportunity to learn and never choose to fail. It's just awesome information in this podcast, guys. Mark my words, you will want to rewind and re-listen on some of these points. Do not miss out on the knowledge and expert perspective from one of the very best to grace our dugouts. Okay, coaches, just sit back and relax. Prop those feet up, pop the earbuds in as we go extra innings with the winningest coach in college baseball history, Augie Garrido. And this great interview is coming at you right now. Okay, coaches, fired up, doesn't even come close to the excitement level that I have for this interview. The opportunity to sit down with an ABCA Hall of Famer, the winningest coach in college baseball history, 51 years as a head coach. We're talking 15 College World Series appearances, 5 national championships spread over 4 different decades. The only thing we couldn't swing Augie in the budget was a smoke machine for that intro, but we'll look to get it for the next time. But I want to welcome you, Coach, to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. Coach Garrido, thanks for being on with us.
Thank you. I'm honored to have a chance to be involved with the podcast, not knowing what they were before we started.
we had to do a little bit of education to make sure we're all squared up, but this is going to be a lot of fun, and we're excited about this. So, coaches, there's a lot that we want to cover here, and I'm going to go ahead and give you the warning on the front end. You can throw your timepiece out the window. We're going to wind Augie up. We're going to let him loose on these airwaves and let him just go because we've got a lot we want to cover, a lot of things we want to reflect on. But let's start right here because we've got 51 years, Coach, that you spent in a dugout. So let's go back to the beginning, and we'll work our way back up to the current. But you've got a great story to tell in terms of when you first decided to become a career coach and you had that conversation with your family, and it actually involved a yo-yo. So if you could break that down for us, open that up.
Well, my dad was, he worked on the shipyard during the day, and he was passionate about sports. So he was the community building, kind of like the YMCA in Vallejo, California, director at night and on the weekends. So he did a lot of coaching and was always the captain of the team when he played on the fast pitch softball teams and basketball teams. And so he was way into sports. So when I got out of the Army, I had found, I told him that what I was going to do was go to college, and because I was going to be a coach. And he told me that you can't be a coach. That's not a real job. That's fun. You have to go to work and make a living for your family. And that's the way he thought about it. Well, he was coming off the Depression, and he was an immigrant from Spain, and so it was real hard for him to understand anything else but surviving. Mm-hmm. However, I was excited about the opportunities to become a coach and knew that I had to go to college to be able to fulfill my dreams. I tried to reason with him. I wasn't getting anywhere with him. So finally I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, I saw something recently on Ed Sullivan. We had a 10-inch black and white Philco TV, the only one in the neighborhood in those days. And I said, I was watching TV, and they had a guy on there that was spinning a yo-yo. And when I was a kid, I won all of the yo-yo contests. It didn't matter, you know, where it was or why it was. But I came out the winner at spinning a yo-yo. And somehow that gave me enough confidence to make the following statement. I said, Dad, I saw a guy spinning a yo-yo on Ed Sullivan, and he got paid. He was on national television, and it was because he was the best of anyone in the country that could spin a yo-yo. So what I know is if I go out and I become the best coach, then I'm going to have a job, I'm going to make a living, and I'm going to be successful as a coach. I said, because if you're just the best, you can do that. And by the way, Dad, I could have beat that guy on Ed Sullivan spinning a yo-yo. And it was just that confidence I had from winning all the blue ribbons. To this day, I still think I could have beat the guy. But that part didn't matter. It was the confidence that I had that I could be, if I was the best at whatever I was going to do, that you could become successful. And that's what drove me and still drives me.
It's outstanding. And so you're kind of moving on this path, and now we're getting into being a career coach. And we're, you know, and I think that this is the way I look at it. It really accentuated your decision because, as fate would have it, you got paired up with Coach Pete Biden from Fresno State, and you chose to go be a Bulldog. But I've sat, and we were reflecting before we started recording, I've sat with Bob Bennett, who's one of our ABCA board members, former head coach there at Fresno State, and he speaks so highly of Coach Biden, who is really a true teacher of the game. And I know your relationship with him, he really shaped your perspective on coaching, but also the game itself. Will you kind of unpack that for us a little bit?
Well, I think he was, absolutely. He was the first person that I ran into that answered questions about why you did things in baseball, both offensively and defensively. An example was after being on campus for about 4 or 5 days, and I was a second baseman throughout my high school days, and he came up to me and he said, you know, boy, where do you play? And I said, well, second base. And I was standing out on the diamond at the time between first and second. And he said, no, where do you play? And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And he said, against a right-handed hitter, you play 4 steps over off the bag and 8 steps back in the home base position. And then you make your adjustment 2 steps at a time to whether he's a slight pull hitter and a pull hitter, or a slight opposite hitter and an opposite hitter. And I just had taken in more information than I'd ever heard in detail about anything that had to do with baseball. And it just went on from there the entire time I was there. And I was extremely fortunate to play one of the masters of the game while most coaches in college during that period of time were actually using the major league model for how they managed the team. They really weren't teachers at that point in time. Hmm. Pete was a teacher, but most of the coaches were managers, like major league managers. They just told what people to, you know, people to do and when to bunt or that kind of thing. But Pete was a teacher day in and day out of practice. He had a formula for everything. And that stayed with me throughout my coaching career. He and I were attracted to each other from that point of view. And then Pete also was a very tough love kind of hombre.
Sure.
And so yep. We had our moments of misunderstanding when two hard-headed people get together that are set in their ways.
Sure.
But by the way, he won every one of those.
That's, you know, even Coach Bennett just reflected. He goes, you know, it was absolutely what you said, a master at teaching the game, but a very gruff personality. That was his direct quote, very gruff is how he defined Coach Biden, who, by the way, is an ABC Hall of Famer as well.
Well, let me, and a wonderful guy and a great coach and has sure. done so much and continues to do so much for mm-hmm. college baseball. So Bob was one of his prize students because Bob was a catcher himself and Pete was a catcher and they caught with the non-hinged catcher's glove. And that was a big deal for Pete.
If
you were going to be a catcher, you had to learn how to catch the ball, not just reach out and grab it, how to catch it. And it took a non-hinged glove to be able to do that. And Bob was the best of probably all of the catchers that played at Fresno State. And then went on to become one of the greatest coaches in Fresno State history.
Well, getting away from Fresno now, we're moving past your career, and you got drafted by the Indians, signed with the Indians, and you played professional baseball. And but you knew that you wanted to coach. You knew you still had this career goal of getting into coaching, and you kicked it off. You jumped right in Sierra High School there in California. You had a stop at San Francisco State, you know, Cal Poly. And I'm really interested, especially, you know, maybe even being that first year head coach there at Sierra, but even your, you know, those couple years there through Cal Poly, who were you then? You got a pretty good idea who you are now, coach, but were there some humbling moments for you there as you broke into coaching, and what did you at that time, looking back, you still needed to figure out?
I still needed to figure out to hang up my ego at the door. So
there you go.
There weren't very many humbling moments at that point in time because I thought I knew everything. And so when you know everything, it's always somebody else's fault.
Sure.
But I was lucky to be able to start at the high school level because I did make a lot of mistakes in the way I dealt with people and how I saw the game as more important than the people involved with it at that point in time. And Sierra High School was a good starting place because it was very, you know, the game is very humiliating in and of itself. And the more you understand the game, the more humble you become because you can't conquer it. And at Sierra Union High School, it was up in the foothills of the Sierras, and many of the players on the team were off the Indian reservations that are up there. And we actually screened all of the boys in school, which wasn't a high number, something like 250, by having the softball throw and some running events. And two of the eventual pitchers actually threw the softball over 300 feet in their physical education class.
Wow.
And that's how they became the pitcher, recognized as potential pitchers, and ended up being good high school pitchers. At San Francisco State, I had a bunch of guys that were just, some of them were older and some of them more mature. Some of them were working and going to school. It was my first year as a college coach, and a very exciting period of time. And to this day, many of the relationships that I treasure are from that San Francisco State team. And then on to Cal Poly. And it was at Cal Poly where I really encountered losing for the first time as a player or a coach. And that was truly a humbling experience. And I think we went 15-33 the first year I was there. And I spent the summer wondering whether I had made the right career choice and that maybe dentistry was what I should have been thinking about. So, as I sat on the dock of the bay, as Otis Redding would say, thinking about what I should really be doing, I started in and I became aware of having to make adjustments because I had lost control of the team. I made things worse, not better. And I didn't know what to do about it. And I read a book, I read several books, but I really copied and put into my lifestyle of coaching a book by Maxwell Maltz called Psycho-Cerebrenetics. And that's still around. And a lot of people at that point in time read that book and found themselves in it and found a better self in it because it was about the mental aspects of Maxwell Maltz was a plastic surgeon. And he found out that after he did this surgery, the people did look better on the outside, but hadn't improved on the inside and still saw themselves as ugly people. And he had made some adjustments to what he was doing in his practice of plastic surgery to deal with the mental game. And the methods that he used to relax a person, get focused on the right things, he talked about process. He talked about a lot of, gave you drills actually for you to use at home to dig deeper into the meditation and getting more aware of yourself. And it worked. It mattered. And then I taught that book to the Cal Poly team in the fall of the very next season. Most of the players who had played on that 15 and 33 team were back. And we had the best team in the history of the school for a long time. The year after that with the same players, we Wow. did add a couple of pitchers that were really good. And we went 39-11 and finished third in the country in Division II, just over making the mental adjustments to that were needed to better understand each other, communicate better, be a lot more selfless. So that was really a major turning point.
Wow. And let's call a couple things. First of all, that is the very first psycho-cybernetics reference on our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. So, Augie, thanks for that. And that's going to set us up later as we get into the mental game stuff. That's a really good reference point for us to come back to that we'll dive into in depth as we continue to move forward. We seem to always get into this topic on our podcast. Seems like every coach that we talk to, and obviously we'd be completely remiss if we didn't ask you this, but so many of our listeners, you know, the podcast format and the social media and the way that we get this information out, you know, so many of our listeners are young coaches. And so they're within their first few years of the game. And we have some older seasoned experienced coaches as well, but always think about the young coach. I'm only 35. I got a chance to coach for 12 years. And I look back at that and remember, you know, what did I need to know there at 23? So if you had a chance, what advice would you give those young cats that are out there coaching? What do they need to hear right now? And some of those lessons you just went into, but what would you offer to them right now that'll maybe send their development down the right path?
I think the most important thing that I hear about from different people is the differences in the players, and that the players are the select team players, the travel team players. And the biggest single complaint I hear amongst the coaches is that, you know, they don't know how to compete. They know how to play the game on an individual basis, but they pay to play. And so they don't know how, they haven't learned how to compete for a job, and they don't have a clear understanding of teamwork, which is absolutely essential to championships.
Sure.
So my point to the coaches that are out there right now is we are the adults. We are the mentors. We are the ones responsible for making every effort to help the players help themselves fulfill their destiny, even though they're different than they were. Evolution's been around for a while. It's going to continue to be around for a lot longer. So we need to make adjustments. And I would like to pass on that I think that the young coaches that are out there now and all coaches that are out there now This is the most important time for the coaches to provide the student athlete with what they need and don't have yet. We need to learn, we need to address the issues connected to how we're going to get the players to compete. Mm-hmm. For the coaches to see that they are more important now in their role as coach, in their relationship with the players, to teach them all of these things that are not being taught in the classroom or other environments, rather than be bogged down by the fact that they don't come to the coach with these qualities. We now have this new starting place in our careers, but we have never been more needed by the player than we are now. That's my opinion.
And we were reflecting on that a couple weeks ago. Again, I got you all fired up because we were talking about along the same lines, you know, where a coach references back, they're just not like the old school guys. They don't know how to compete. They, you know, and certainly entitlement, that's a part of our culture. That's certainly wrapped up in our evaluation of these players. But at the same time, to your point, I think it directly is a call for better leaders. It's a time to step up and be better for our players and provide them what they need and stay true to what we know is right.
You're absolutely right. And the only thing I would say about that is, you know, the coaches don't necessarily have to get better. And this is just semantics because they're doing the best they can. Mm-hmm. But I think if we all realize how much we are needed right now to develop confidence, to develop self-esteem in our players, to develop leadership, to develop teamwork, all of those big words, who else is teaching that? Where else are they getting it? If we're complaining about it, we are using up the space in our minds and our thought processes and not solving anything. If we look to identify the problem, which is what we're doing, let's work on the solutions. Mm-hmm. Let's find solutions. Well, we have to have our own level of confidence before we can do that. Why are we doing this? What is our purpose? Well, our purpose is to develop each individual so that we can create a better society. And teamwork, leadership, sacrifice, hard work, work ethic, all of the big words that we know about that go into being a citizen and making important contributions to our societies are available like at no other time. Mm-hmm. For coaches of all sports.
Coaches, we're talking with ABCA Hall of Famer, legendary Augie Garrido, and we're going to kind of move in towards your time there as a Titan. You certainly were the architect behind building the program there at Cal State Fullerton. So I really want to lean in on this one because talking with Rick Vanderhook, we've had him on the show, but we did our Barnstormers Clinic out there, and we've had a chance to really dive into some of the history of the program and how things have come to fruition. But, I mean, first off, what the program looked like when you took over? I know it was on a city field, and we've really built Goodwin Field up very significantly, but I think off the recruiting side of things, you guys defined the proverbial chip-on-the-shoulder player, and you went out and you attacked that recruiting trail to find those players that weren't looking maybe at Cal State Fullerton, but they fit your niche of what you wanted. So again, what the program looked like, but then how did you go about that recruiting trail to find the guys that helped build that program for you in those early years?
Well, the program, I thought the 15 and 33 year at Cal Poly was going to be the worst year that I ever experienced as a coach. But at Fullerton, the first year surpassed that. We were 12 and 44 the first year.
That's firm.
And so, and so it was a new beginning. Mm-hmm. And it was a recreational field. Anybody that has seen the movie that Richard Linklater, the Academy Award-winning director, did, the documentary on my life, mm-hmm. Inning by Inning Portrait of a Coach, it's available on Amazon if anybody wants to see that, as is my book, Life is Yours to Win. And yes, it goes through a lot of the details that we're talking about now. So anybody that listens to the podcast that might want to dig deeper into the details can do that by approaching. That's where the rant came from, by the way.
Sure.
I will take no defense for that. It was It was a moment in time that belonged to me.
Sure.
And I think I explained that during that period of time. But anyway, back to the recruiting part for how what we looked for at Cal State Fullerton was not necessarily the strongest guy, the fastest guy, but the guy that was committed with a work ethic. And we built the program on relationships. Mm-hmm. We built it on the fact that we were going to do a better job of teaching and player development than anyone else, because there wasn't a lot of player development going on in those days like there is now. Player development in those days really belonged to Major League Baseball. They were the ones that were using the minor leagues, a la Branch Rickey and his model for how to develop an organization and how to develop Major League Baseball players. But we decided that, along with, you know, Dave Snow was instrumental in all of this, and as were a lot of other people, George Horton, the list could go on and on. But mm-hmm. Dave was with me right at the early beginning of all of this. And Dave was connected to Cerritos Junior College and the great Wally Kincaid, the coach sure. there, who, by the way, actually went to summer school to take and enrolled in Pete Biden's summer school class.
Wow.
On baseball. So that lineage, that whole family thing is a pretty good strand.
Sure.
To all of us. But back to the point, and Dave was extremely instrumental in all of the success that went on, not only in the early days, in the ongoing days of Cal State Fullerton. But to get that started, we took the players that were not the major league draftable type player, and we had a responsibility for development, and that's what we sold the players on. We played a lot of games. There were no game day limits, you know. Mm-hmm. There weren't any of the rules that we have now regarding time. And we just simply outworked everybody in our efforts to develop a better baseball player and to be with that baseball player from beginning to end, and where a lot of the programs were very impersonal at that point in time. More of the programs, almost all of the programs now of national prominence are built on player development, and they have great teachers as coaches. And that is proven by Major League Baseball drafting more and more from the college development programs, because Major League Baseball can see that the college baseball players that are coming out of the three-year programs and are signing are making it to the major leagues sooner. They're much more predictable to make it in the major leagues, and it costs them a lot less to get them to the major leagues. So
that's right.
College baseball has come a long ways from the player development point of view. I take no credit in starting that, but we had to do something different. We couldn't get the best players, so we had to develop the best players. And in developing the best players, we also had to develop the best mental game along with the physical game to be able to accomplish what we set out to accomplish. And we used the power of the game itself to overcome teams with better players but didn't have the same level of commitment to teamwork or work ethic at that time. So that was really the magic in it all. We took the rejected player, and one of the things that I think happened during the period of time was Tim Wallach was the first Golden Spike Award winner from Cal State Fullerton. Mm-hmm. Great player, now the bench coach for the Miami Marlins. Then he was followed by Phil Nevin, who was a Golden Spike Awards winner, and later on Mark Kotze. So mm-hmm. Cal State Fullerton, during that period of time that we're talking about right now, developed three of the best players in the country, according to the people that did the voting in those days for the Golden Spike Awards winner. And we developed teamwork. We put a heavy emphasis on teamwork. I'm not much of a cliche guy, but we did have one that we lived by. It's amazing what can be accomplished when no one cares who gets the credit.
Wow.
And that was really how we drove the bus.
You know, I love the fact you talk about how committed the team they were and their work ethic was exceptional and probably different than maybe some of the highly touted players in that area. But I'm interested, again, recruiting the guys that aren't the major league draftable type player or the prototypical. I'm sure the frame wasn't always there. You probably got sometimes an undersized or not as muscular of a player. You probably got the scrappier kid as opposed to the kid that's had everybody tell him he was great. Maybe the kid was the backup to the great player. But I'm sure there's a level of toughness and a mindset, like you talked about improving their mental game, but I'm guessing along those first few years, you got a player that had something that those highly touted players really wished and hoped that they had. Is that about right?
That's really an accurate statement. And this is my theory on why all players need God. First of all, the tall, talented, gifted player that God gave all the speed, the throwing arm, the power, everything comes pretty easy for them. Mm-hmm. They don't develop the mental toughness or the competitiveness. They don't have that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the smaller guy who is passionate about the game would do anything to play the game. He gets all the passion, but is 5'8", doesn't
right.
run real well. So now everybody needs God, the guy that's got all the gifts and the guy that doesn't have the gifts. They all need God
sure.
to make them into a Major League Baseball player. But that's also baseball. Baseball can accommodate and provide opportunity for more body types
sure.
than most of the other sports, which is proven in the major leagues now. And I don't need to be the one to give examples, but there are small guys that drive the team. It's interesting to me how emotions still drive the world championships.
Mm-hmm.
When all of the talent at the major league level is the best they can find in the world to put the teams together, the team that seems to be winning the world championship is driven by a motivation that is exceptional to normal and goes beyond the agents, goes beyond the self-gratification, goes beyond the money. And it gets right back down to the simplicity of the game itself, the heart and soul of the game of baseball, and that is opportunity and teamwork. And before you can have teamwork, you have to have trust. And all of the human qualities that we want to see in the people of our country are demanded by the game of baseball. And when they're fulfilled, they're recognized, and the ultimate reward on the team, within the team, and forever in life is respect.
Period. Well said. I'm wondering this, Coach, we could stay on this for one more question. As you guys, because obviously getting there in the early, mid-70s, and it really took you 4 or 5 years to win a national championship there in 79, did the recruiting change once you kind of got over the hump and the success that you were having, making a couple College World Series appearances, did it become easier to find those Titan players that you really needed that were fit your model, or did it become more difficult because you had more players that had interest in coming to play for you and be part of what you guys were building there?
The 75 team was the miracle team.
Mm-hmm.
John Manuel, who is one of the originals for Baseball America,
sure.
made the comment that the 1975 Cal State Fullerton baseball team, their championship, it was our first year of Division I at Fullerton after only 2 years of being there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a $6,000 budget, and we were picked last in the conference in our first year in the Pacific Coast Athletic Association. And we won the conference, which meant we were going to the regional championships and had a chance to go to Omaha in our first year of Division I.
Right.
Well, the problem is we were in the regional, and our first game was with the USC Trojans.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, the Trojans had won 5 consecutive national championships and were number one in the country,
mm-hmm.
leading into their quest for a 6th national championship. And that was our first game in the regional championships. And we won.
Yep.
We won 3-1. And we went on to win that championship when our players were driving their own cars with their mom and dad and packing their own lunches to get to the ballpark to play the best in the country at that time, USC, Arizona, and Pepperdine. So it was God's gift to my coaching career. And most of those players are still friends today. And John Manuel called it the greatest upset in the history of Division I sports.
Mm.
And I believe that. It just cannot be done.
Sure.
So, but it was. And after that, that's when the recruiting changed.
Yeah.
Not immediately, but the year at the recruiting season was over by the time we had accomplished that. But what followed was Wallach and several other players that they weren't, you know, Wallach was passed over several times in the draft because he was tall and he was thin and he didn't appear to be too strong. And he developed, he went to a junior college and was passed over by the major league draft. And so he developed at Cal State Fullerton and became the nation's best player. And the rest is history. That the recruiting the players, then we never really got too tied up with Major League Baseball. If they wanted a player, they probably were going to get that player during that period of time. So we stayed away from that. But we also were in probably the best baseball area you could be in. Fullerton was sitting in the middle of all of the baseball talent that was all around us, mm-hmm. with great coaches in that area at every level, high school level, junior college level, and a chance to play baseball. I mean, the team that Wallach was on that won the national championship in 79, they played 55 games in the fall. And when they won the national championship, their record was 60-14. So they had played 55 games and 74 games. And that may have something to do with the timelines that are now in place.
Sure, sure. Has a little something to do with it.
We developed baseball players, but there weren't a lot of sheepskins being passed out in those days.
Well said. You know, we were talking earlier about the the mental game, and I think this is where this might come back into play. But, you know, in terms of how you've gone about coaching and teaching, it's very apparent you've been ahead of the curve on the importance of mental game and making sure that you're shaping your players and your teams and guiding their thoughts, keeping things simple. Love how you always come back to just opportunity for what it is. But you keep their focus on the process. You don't let them get bogged down with looking ahead at results or looking back at results. So I guess maybe it was back, that year at Cal Poly, but when did it really start to make sense for you in terms of how you coached? Not just what you knew, but how you were able to really apply it. And I guess for a coach out there that's listening, how do we buy into this mentality? How do they move towards really adapting and adopting this framework of trust in the process?
I knew about it, but I didn't know how to teach it that well.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about the fundamentals of the game. For the most part, we didn't teach the mentality parts. We didn't talk about it a lot. We just taught the fundamentals of the game. But we were together so much and we played so often that we did make reference to a lot of what people would call play the game right. I saw this morning in the newspaper about a player that came out of Long Beach State that's going to be the second baseman for the Angels now. And the Long Beach State program was developed to a national level by Dave Snow, who mm-hmm. I talked about earlier, who played for me and also coached with me and had a huge responsibility in developing the Cal State Fullerton program,
right,
and the Cal State Fullerton mentality. And his nickname for his players was the Dirtbags.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dirtbag was a guy that was just the ball player, with bloody knees and snot running down his nose and skinned up elbows because he didn't care what he looked like. He wasn't the prospect who looked good in the uniform and ran well, threw well, and hit it far. far when he hit it, but didn't know how to compete or didn't know how to do anything. He was a guy just battling his butt off to play.
Sure.
And that mentality, as of this morning, was respected by the Angel organization as the kind of player that they're looking for.
Sure, no doubt.
No doubt. So when it comes to winning the game, players, that's what we were teaching. We were teaching the players the role that they, the right way to play the game so that they could help a team win the game. That was our focus. Mm-hmm. It was all about winning the game. So you say, well, that's not about process. Yes, it is, because you have to back down from the results, because you can't control the results at all, into the level at which you have some control. And
sure.
To do that, I met Ken Revisa, who is well known for his brilliant efforts to make the mental game simple and easily understood, still hard to get across because of the receiver of the information. It still is difficult to change your focus to something else that needs to be done, the process, and trust it. But I met Ken when he was the United States Olympic women's gymnastics coach. Hmm. And we had a great gymnastics team, men's and women's, at Cal State Fullerton at that time. And he was working with them to overcome their fears and on, you know, the new tricks and the mental issues connected to performances. And I watched him as he talked the young ladies and the men through their routines and thought to myself, well, if this is working, which was working, to develop a better athlete and to develop better performances, what's the difference between gymnastics and baseball? They're both a performance that require certain fundamental skills. So let's start talking baseball with Ken, which we did for a couple of years before we ever did anything with it. And then he started coming out to the team, and he and I talked for a couple of years, a couple of times a week. And then he moved on to become in the Angel organization. He was working in the minor leagues to help them better understand what you and I have been talking about. Mm-hmm. That was a time when Joe Maddon was involved as a minor league manager. And Joe Maddon to this day has Ken working with him. Ken was with him for the last 17 days of the Cubs' run to the World Series championship. And so the mental game, what it finally gets down to is the player has to compete, no matter what the environment might be, within the framework of his role, to the best of his ability, for the good of the team. Mm-hmm. That's all there is to it. And you have to simplify it. And the only way you can is to get it down to the pitch-by-pitch, inning-by-inning process. You can't – what happens in nine innings? You can't look back and tell me that with the nuances of every pitch where the umpire missed a call in the fourth inning, that one pitch that he missed a call, and now that really did influence the result of the game. We're going to remember that pitch-by-pitch? Pretty unlikely. So if you're going to get control, you have to simplify it to where you do recognize the value of each pitch from the standpoint that you're going to compete on each pitch. And if you make a bad one, so what? Next pitch. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to stay in the moment. And, you know, that's the mental game. But it was developed over a long period of time. It continues to be developed, and it continues to be more challenging all the time. But it's about simplification. What are you simplifying? A game that is highly complex. Why is it highly complex? Because you don't have control over it.
Sure.
Because the damn thing is played with a ball.
Yep.
And everybody responds to where the ball goes and several other things. And so you can't control it. But
sure.
You can't control things within the process.
Oh, that's... That is, we have a saying on this show, Augie, it's certified audio gold, and you just nailed it on the head. That was great. Well put. That point came together very nicely. Appreciate that. You know, I've heard you speak a few times, feedback from past players, assistant coaches, administrators, all the people that have been involved with you. It always comes back to how you are a master, and you can even hear it through this podcast, just teaching life lessons through the game. And very simply, and it's what you and I got rolling on a couple of weeks ago, just dealing with failure, with success, the embarrassment that seems to be riddled within our game, the individual battles, the setting goals. I love hearing you talk about battling fear with confidence, those type of things. And that's something you've been great at, and preparing them ultimately not just to be great at baseball, but for the biggest game of all of life. So if you could, we'll dive into that for us and kind of draw the parallels for our coaches that may kind of straighten that out for them in terms of recognizing what happens on the field can really parallel with what we need to be teaching them how to react and respond in life.
Yeah, I think that how we respond in life is a byproduct of what we know. But it's also a byproduct of what we fear. It's also a byproduct of both of those things, and some of it is conscious and some of it is subconscious. So it's a very difficult, whatever environment we were brought up in, then that's going to have an influence on who we are in any given moment. However, if you're going to be a performer, which a baseball player is, doesn't matter whether you're a singer, a dancer, a musician, performances are controlled a lot by the same basic fundamentals. And the fundamentals then just become what develops your character. And it's really in three phases. Number one, you have to know about it. And that's the phase that we all are aware of. We think that if we know about something, that's all the farther it has to go. Mm-hmm. We're where we need to be. Well, that's not true. You have to be able to do it. And that's completely different. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I say to myself, my biggest challenge every day is to not to break the promises that I make to myself. You know, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to eat ice cream today. I'm not going to do that.
Now we're getting into the good stuff, Augie. There we go. Let's talk about your ice cream addiction. This is good.
Absolutely. And the better the ice cream, the harder it is. So anyway, so, you know, not to break those promises that we make, but we've got to be able to do what we know about is right, but we don't, and we can't. But we are satisfied that if we know about it, that's all we need. And that's not the right way to think about it. Right way to think about it is, how do we act on the things that we know? And in baseball, how you're acting is in relationship to the role that you have on the team. Mm-hmm. The role that you have on the team dictates the quality of work and the kind of work that you're going to be able to do in practice and in the games. You become responsible for living up to your responsibilities and doing what is needed for the good of the team. And the role may be the bullpen catcher, which is the worst job on the team. But many of the bullpen catchers that we've had in the past never get to take batting practice, never get to play in a game, always get all the bumps and bruises that go along with trying to catch the pitchers that bounce balls and throw them over your head, all of that kind of stuff. The bullpen catcher has the worst job on the team. And he, on our teams, has been given the highest level of respect from his teammates in the last 10 years at the University of Texas. And before that.
Sure.
Because they did it to the best of their ability, but they were clear on what their role was. And that's where it starts. The players want to be something else. They want to be something other than who they are or who they are on this particular team. They're not willing to make the sacrifices that are necessary to fulfill the role that they have on the team, when in fact they must fill that role to be a Major League Baseball player. Because a Major League Baseball player has to be predictable And before you can be predictable, you have to be something, something and someone.
Sure.
So that all fits. But getting the younger player to move from what I call being a prospect and a prospect's mentality. The goals for the prospect, I want to sign a major league contract. I want to get a college scholarship. I want to be the star of the team. These are typical goals of the prospect. The ball player's goal is to help the team win the game, help the team get better. And everyone's goal on the team should be one thing and one thing only, which solves the problem if they can, if everyone on the team can live it, meaning do it. Mm-hmm. And that is, we're learning every day from what happens in practice and in the games. How about if I could guarantee you or any other player that you can win every time you play baseball? How cool would that be?
Sign off right there, right now.
And you can.
Mm-hmm.
How? Because everything that someone else may see as a failure, you recognize as an opportunity to learn from it.
Preach, Augie. Keep going.
And so I think that this is the essence of solving the problems connected to fear, being confident. Who's your best friend in a game? Who is the best friend in a game? Yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you ever treat yourself like a best friend? When you strike out, do you say the same things to yourself as you do to your best friend? No, never.
Right.
Well, let's start doing that. Let's start doing that. When you really feel like you've lost the game as a pitcher or player and the game is over and you start beating up on yourself, when do you treat yourself like you would treat your best friend? Answer that question. Be that person. Be that best friend to yourself, and you will learn how to become a better performer and to fulfill your role. That's my opponent.
Mm. I'll back that up with a great quote that I'm sure you've heard before, but basically it's the mentality of, I choose to never lose. I either win or I learn.
That's it.
You know?
That's exactly right. I've never heard that said before, but that is, in my opinion, exactly right, because there is no losing in that.
Sure.
There is no fear of failure, because there is no failure, because I'm learning. Let's think about this from this point of view. Most of us, I'll speak for myself, most of the things that have impacted the most important changes that I've made in my life have been what I thought was a crisis or a development that I didn't think I could survive. And I made changes because of that. And that's how important what appears to be a failure can be in the success of your being.
Mm. That's awesome. That's great. Coaches, if you're listening, we're still rolling with legendary skipper at Cal State Fullerton and also with the Texas Longhorns. We're talking with Augie Garrido. And this is a question I'm real excited to kind of dive into, because I think it's just a, you know, you think about a player and a team reaching close enough to touch the pinnacle of winning a national championship, but you've reflected that some of your most successful players were guys from teams that lost in the national championship game. So if you could open that up for us, dive into that in terms of how those guys have it shaped their perspective moving forward in life and how they've attacked it.
An eye-opening experience for me was in 1992, and Phil Nevin's team, I use him because he was the star. There were a lot of people on that team, obviously. But Phil Nevin was the first player in the first round of the Major League draft. He was drafted by Houston that year. He was also the Golden Spike Awards winner. He is currently the third base coach for the San Francisco Giants, I am happy to say. Mm-hmm. But in 1992, we lost the national championship game for the first time. And that was a devastating experience. And I, for the first time, I came to understand why some people don't want to take the chance to get that close to the championship of any kind. Because the bigger the championship, the more important it is the harder the fall, the more devastating the loss. We only see on television the people that win. We see a couple of tears or two, and then quickly the cameras move, and all of the accolades go immediately to the winners. So we as an audience are used to seeing and identifying with whoever wins, and that becomes the excitement in it for us. So we relate to that because we are trained as capitalists. Mm-hmm. And in American society, you have to win.
Sure.
That starts in spelling bees in kindergarten, I think.
Right.
You get the gold star, or you have to do the words over with. You know?
Yep.
Yeah, you have to do that. Well, in 1992, I walked into a locker room for the first time and saw devastation on the faces of the players. Tears, anguish, raw emotions like never before. And I didn't know what to say because I felt the same way. I was shocked. I was disappointed. I was surprised. I was all those things. And then I thought about what I could say. And I go back to what I said earlier. Some of the most important, devastating lessons in my life came from such an experience. Mm-hmm. Something that cut me deeper than I'd ever been cut before. Something I thought I might not recover from. Something I never realized meant so much to me until I lost it. And now I feel this way. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
My question to myself is, what can you do about it? And what I said was something along these lines. What I know for sure is that all of you in this room, despite how you feel right now, will recover from this moment. And this will make you stronger, better, and more successful for the rest of your lives. You will never want to feel this way again. You will seldom, if ever, finish second in whatever you choose to pursue. And that's the way it turned out. So many of those players have gone on to be dentists, doctors, bankers, real estate people. You know, and Fullerton wasn't known as the Phi Beta capital of the United States. So we weren't exactly producing world-class leaders at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But they were world-class people. And they went on, and as after a long period of time, I looked back on all these individuals that were on that team, and that held true. So many of them, many more of them, went on to become very special in whatever field they chose for their life than the teams that won. Remember, we won 16 championships out of 21 tries at Fullerton.
Sure, sure.
We won a lot. And so I saw a lot of players experience winning. However, 1992 showed me the power of losing when the person and the people involved really have the right attitude toward learning.
He was getting ready to come right back to it. We just talked about it, the opportunity to flip that experience and treat it as a learning opportunity instead of really getting bogged down with the failure that encompasses it. That's exactly it, to a point.
Everything like that becomes life skills. Everything that just translates into life skills.
Sure.
Because now maybe you spend a lot more time getting prepared, but you think about everything that went wrong and what you could do to make it better. We only needed one more run to tie. And we only needed two more runs to win.
Mm-hmm.
What could we have done over the 150 days that we had prior to that loss to do better?
That's it.
And you think about that.
One of the things that's very impressive that jumps off the page is of all the wins, the awards, the rings, all the things that you've accomplished, in hearing you speak, and even after a national championship at our Hall of Fame banquet, you are consistently but more you quickly shift attention to your players and the teams. And it's something, to be honest, it's very admirable that that's part of your personality and your perspective. But how did you come about gaining that perspective? Because again, a guy that's had so much success, you could easily walk around and drink the Augie juice and really believe the hype, but you've refused that and you've shifted completely back to your players and your teams. How have you been able to keep that perspective throughout your whole career?
Because it wasn't something I kept. It was something I learned.
There it is.
After the 79 National Championship, I thought I had proven to my dad that I could keep my job and I could be the best at what I was doing. So I proved to him that if I was the best at what I was doing, I could keep my job. That was the number one thing that drove me. Okay. However, when I saw a picture after the game, Tim Wallach is standing on one side of me and Matt Vejar is standing on the other. There's three of us in this picture. And I have got I had my hat pulled down and I've got the trophy and I've got both arms embracing that trophy, holding it over my heart. Okay? Mm. Like the Hamburglar.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Yep.
Yeah. I'm looking around. Who's going to reach for this thing? Because this thing belongs to me.
Oh, wow.
It's mine. Mm-hmm. It belongs to me. I saw that picture and I put it up on the wall in my office and said, this is wrong.
Yep.
This isn't true. Mm. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to everyone. I don't even know what percentage belongs to me. Do I take the bat out of the player's hand on top of the trophy? Is that mine? Or
sure.
Do I get half the trophy? Or how much trophy does Bill Kernan get, my assistant?
Yeah.
Or Dave Snow get? How many pieces do we chop it up to? We had 23 players. Who does this belong? I really didn't know. But I knew it didn't belong to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went back to Fullerton, all the things I thought that would change, it didn't. It actually made them worse. And I thought it was the things around me that made it worse. But in time, I realized it was because I had, here's a killer word, expectations of what should happen when we won. And none of those expectations were fulfilled. Okay?
Yeah.
My life did not change in a positive way because we became the national champion. In fact, in 1980, I was so afraid of losing that I could barely make it through the games, fearful of losing that trophy and not winning again. It was one of the most miserable years of my coaching career. Okay?
Wow.
So the Cal Poly situation where I lost control of the team that we talked about earlier and whether I should be a dentist, a trout fisherman, or a coach after 15-33 record, first year of losing, now this is another 79-80 period of time. And I was devastated. It did not work the way I thought it should work. I finally abandoned the word expectations, and to this day, understand the only way you can deal with expectations is by converting and balancing the word with perception.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because expectations by themselves are glittering generalities about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They're just an opinion. So with that said, that's where the transition really took another step. Now, it took us until 84 to win again, but we did. We won in 84. And at the end of the game, they took a picture. And this time, the players had me up on top of their shoulders. They had the trophy. I was smiling and waving, and all the players were gathered around with big smiles on their face. And that was the beginning of an important transition.
Oh, that's great. Did you frame that picture as well?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man.
So from there, then it became an ongoing challenge to continue to recognize the truth. I never took another trophy. Yep. I've never taken another trophy. It's always belonged to the players. And the truth of that just is the truth. It represents the truth. Coaches can lose games, but they can't win.
Well, that's it.
They don't get to play. Coaches don't have the right relationships with their players for the most part. I'm talking about myself now. I'm not talking about people listening to this. I'm talking about myself.
Sure.
When I don't have the right relationship with my assistants, or if I don't have the right relationships with the players and the team doesn't do nearly as well. So relationships are the key. Why? Because teamwork is based on one word, trust, because there's no communications without trust. And so now we're keeping it real simple, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the key to the whole thing. The whole explanation for role-playing, performances, teamwork, leadership, all those words that apply to everything on a daily basis that go into, here's a word for us, the choices we make are what we become. All of those things go into that.
Sure.
I want to tell a story about that. Do I have time to do that?
Coach, you have all the time in the world, my friend.
All right. One of the things that Ken Ravisa taught me was the importance of the moment. We all know about, living our life in the moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you really dig into that, we don't do it. So we go back to the three phases of learning, two of which I've talked about. One is we know about it. Two, we talked about doing it. And that's been in a lot of what we've been saying here. The third part is to own it. That's when it becomes a part of us. We're not even reaching back into what we know. We just are that. That's who we've become. So that's what happened with the transition for me to get from clutching the trophy, feeling the ownership. I hung up my ego at the door. And that's when things got better. And that's when I knew it was all about relationships. Well, one of the things I like to do is I'm fascinated by artists of all kinds, actually, because they're about performances.
Mm-hmm.
But artists break boundaries, and I'm always curious about that. And one of the artists is a guy named Chuck Close, and he paints in dots, or he does murals and dots, and he does large-scale projects. And I got a chance to meet him, and I asked him, why do you work in such a tedious way to create your art? And he said, because that's the way we live our life. One moment, one dot at a time. And by the time we're finished and we look at the canvas, we see the truth about who we are and what it's about. That's a good enough answer for me.
Yikes. Wow. Oh, man, that's as good as it gets. Oh, there's some hair standing up on end in the ABCA office right now. Appreciate that. You know, you're talking about these players, Coach, and I know it's tough. You've coached so many great players, but we have a question that we talk about on our podcast. Let's talk about maybe players that you have. Maybe there's four or five special guys. You referenced the Golden Spikes winners, and I'm sure Mark Kotze is in this group, but who are some of those guys that you look at throughout your coach career that were just, maybe not just the best player, but they were just a different level of player, person that would fit up on your Mount Rushmore?
All right. Well, first of all, I have to preface this. I'm going to give you four or five names.
Sure.
But before I do that, we all have to understand and agree that no one person is that person
mm-hmm.
without all of the others.
Right.
It doesn't matter. We are who we are because of each other. So with that said, everyone is a part of everyone else. The four players or five players that stand out for me would be Tim Wallach,
mm-hmm.
Mark Kotze, Phil Nevin, Houston Street would be the four.
Mm. I would go to battle with that group.
You'd win too.
Yeah. Well said.
You'd win if you were playing a combination of pickup sticks and tiddlywinks. You would win.
Still win. Oh, that's great.
If you moved to darts, there'd be no doubt.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, so many years in the game, over 50 years in our game, there's got to be some moments. We're wide open for as many as you're willing to share, but just some of those funniest moments that you, even sitting in your office now, you lean back and you're like, man, that I still can see myself in that moment. It's still funny today. What are some of those stories you would share with us?
I'm going to start with what first one that pops into my mind. I don't have them ranked or anything, but so in 2002 at Texas, we lose the last game of the season to Texas A&M at Dish Falk Field, our home field, mm-hmm. which causes us to finish in a tie for first place, okay?
Okay.
So that's a pretty rough day in Austin when that kind of thing happens. So I talked to the team about getting ready for the regionals and the loss, and then I go into my little old office. It was before the remodel, and I'm sitting there, and everybody's gone, and kind of feeling sorry for myself, got my head in my hands, and head pops in the door. It's Omar Quintanilla. Mm-hmm. And he goes, Coach, you doing all right, man? I said, yeah, Omar, I'm doing all right. I said, but you know, to lose to those guys here, that's tough, man. I said, and you know, suicide doesn't sound like such a bad idea right now. He says, Coach, can I have your Porsche?
Bringing you right back to earth on that one.
Yeah. The teamwork was out of it at this point.
That's it.
Let's start to negotiate for something I can use.
That's great.
Yeah. So that was one of the unexpected things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think another story that I find fascinating and heroic from the standpoint of the player. We're playing Baylor, and Baylor in the College World Series, and this is the game to go into the finals. Now, we've played Baylor four times during the regular season, and we've lost to them four times.
Wow.
So now this fifth time, we're in the game, and we are tied. We're the home team in the bottom of the ninth. And our first baseman, Chance Wheelis, mm-hmm. is coming to bat. And Chance has separated his shoulders two games before and is having a terrible time when he swings and misses at a pitch. If he hits it, he's okay. But if he swings and misses, the pain is excruciating. One knee type collapses. Mm-hmm. But we really had no one else, and he was willing to battle it out. Now, he is leading off in the bottom of the ninth in this tie game in Omaha. And I go up to him and I said, Chance, we're going to pinch hit for you now. And they bring in a pitcher that is warming up at the same time that I'm talking to Chance. And Chance says, and he's a real quiet guy. And he says, Coach, as I was turning away to walk away, he says, Coach, I can really hit this guy. He knows it and I know it. I've played against him all my life. And I always hit this guy. And I said, Chance, what about your shoulder? He says, it's not going to matter. So I walk toward the dugout, toward the other end of the dugout, and I leave him in the game. My assistant coaches come up and go, what are you doing? Are you out of your mind? I said, wait a minute. All the time I hear from you guys and other coaches, the kids aren't as tough as they used to be when I played. They don't have any guts anymore. They won't grind it out. They want this. They want that. All these. I just heard a guy say, he can do it. He can do it. And you know what? I don't care whether he does or not. I just want to see what happens.
Sure.
And he hits a home run to win the game. Unbelievable.
That's our game.
And that leads me to this point. Many people accept the fact that baseball is a game of failure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Many people. I disagree with that. Chance Wheelis proved that it's a game of opportunity. I was doing some broadcasting for the Little League Regional Championship And Perlin had a third baseman who had struck out five times in a row, and he is coming up in a game-winning situation, or they are not moving on to the Little League World Series if they don't win this game. They're one run behind. There's one out left. He has struck out five times in a row. And we're discussing in the booth who they had to pinch hit and should he pinch hit. And the coach leaves the third baseman, a defensive player, in the game. He hits a home run. Is it a game of failure,
right,
or is it a game of opportunity? It's a game of opportunity. And that's why baseball should be America's pastime, because it's about opportunity. That's my opinion.
Love it. Coach, so many games, so many opportunities to compete against some of the very best, you know, all the household names that we as college baseball lovers know. Who were some of those ones that you really loved to compete against? And if you had any moments from those games that you still see so vividly, or reflect on that, offer that to us a little bit.
Well, I mean, the list could be
sure.
endless.
Sure.
I just got back from Palo Alto, so Mark Marquess, of course, becomes one. This is his final year at Stanford, and over the years, we actually played on the same team when he was 18 years old.
Oh, wow.
He's been at Stanford for 41 years, so I was up there to see the series between Texas and the Stanford, and Mark has just always been a great competitor, a warrior with his great teams, won two national championships. He won the gold medal for the United States in the Olympics. Bob Bennett was one of those coaches when he was at Fresno State. When you lost a game, you would go back and learn from it, because you got out coached if that was the case, but you certainly explored it because of all of the great things. Rod Dedeaux had a tremendous influence on me by watching him and the way he did things during that period of time. There's so many great young coaches out there right now at the college level doing a great job of teaching. I mean, just look around at all of the great players that are coming out of the universities into the major leagues and what they're doing there. My understanding is there's four college signees on every major league team to every one high school signee from the United States.
That's a great stat.
Yeah, that just speaks volumes for all of the coaches. Look at the diversity of the types of teams that are going to the College World Series now. Mm-hmm. And winning Coastal
sure.
Carolina,
yeah,
winning. So we were that team in 1979. It hadn't been done until 79. And now it becomes an opportunity for many teams from different parts of the country to be highly successful. And so the changes in the game are just benefiting the entire industry, and the industry has come so far. So Mark Marquess is on that list. Mike Martin at Florida State, you know, just the list just goes on and on.
Sure.
And on.
Well, you brought it up. I got a couple more questions for you. You brought up Omaha.
Okay.
And you've been there 15 times. I mean, you've been there so much. You probably got a townhome there that you rent. What are your fondest memories from the College World Series? What are the things that stick out to you now that, again, you knew your way around, you knew the people there, had such a great bond with the Fullerton and Texas teams? What are your fondest memories of being at the Omaha, the College World Series?
It has played such an important part of my life that my fondest memories are about the relationship that I have with the College World Series, with the people of Omaha, with the coaches, with the NC2A, just all the people that have provided that opportunity for any college coach to achieve their goals. Mm-hmm. I first played in the College World Series in 1959
yep.
with Fresno State.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot to do with losing the game.
Oh, really?
We lost. Yeah, so I was playing left field. The score was tied. We were playing Oklahoma State, and the winner of the game was going to play Arizona, who had a bye for the national championship the next day. And there was a runner on second in about the sixth inning, and they hit a ball through the infield, and I picked it up as the left fielder and demonstrated a very strong throwing arm. However, that was the good news. The bad news was it was very inaccurate as well. So it hit about halfway up the screen, and not only did the winning run score, eventually it was a winning run score, but it set up the second run by not holding the runner to first base.
Right.
So that run scored. So we lost 2-0 and went packing. And also I went from the all-star left fielder in our conference to the bullpen catcher in the very next inning. That was some of the rough love I talked about.
Sure.
Forgiveness was not a word
right.
in his vocabulary. So it became very clear I lost the game.
Okay? Shit.
So as I sat on that curb waiting for the yellow school bus, really that's how they transported us yep. in those days, I was crying my eyes out. And in 1979, when we won, that curb was still there, and I jumped over it and said, got you this time, baby. Got you this
great.
Time. So it is a most meaningful place
sure.
and so proud to be a part of it. And I think the fact that Rosenblatt was closed down, none of us liked that. Mm-hmm. The NC2A didn't like it. Nobody liked it. It's like closing Yankee Stadium
sure.
for a lot of us. However, would you rather have a switch to the new stadium, Ameritrade, and keep it in Omaha, or would you rather have it shopped to different parts of the country every year, like every other NC2A championship? Those were the choices.
Sure.
And so I am so thrilled that it has stayed in Omaha. It will always be a most important part of my life. And anything that I can ever give back to it, I always will, whether it's the city, the people involved with it, or the event itself.
You referenced earlier, you know, talking about grabbing the trophy and really clutching it to your heart, and this may fit into one of these that we're going to go into. But if you had to go back looking at your entire coaching career, is there a moment, if any, that you would change or do different or anything that looking back, you know, really in hindsight being 2020, obviously, but is there anything you look at that you go, I probably should have done this?
Oh, yeah. But we don't have 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, right.
To talk about that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, here's one right specific for you, Coach. You know, obviously leaving Fullerton and coming back had its own, I'm sure, effect on you and the program. But would you still leave and go to Illinois for a few years?
For the same reasons, yes. That was okay. over the baseball stadium. We had spent a long time at Fullerton, and I was a small player in a big moment where we had closed the deal to build the baseball stadium, the football stadium at the time, and the track and the softball fields mm-hmm. with the city of Fullerton. And the negotiations had gone on forever, it seemed like. We finally closed the deal. And that was going to happen. Then, unknowingly, we got a new school president. And that school president vetoed that deal. And no matter how hard we pleaded, she would have nothing to do with building that facility. So my former athletic director at Fullerton had moved on to Illinois and was doing very well there, Neil Stoner. And they were going to build a baseball stadium
right
at Illinois. And he committed. And one of the things that happened with that is I was the first college baseball coach, which I thought had a positive effect on our industry, to be hired like a football or basketball coach, where
sure.
we got multi-year contracts and all the stuff that should go into that kind of thing. And it immediately had a positive effect throughout many of the coaches in the country. And so I didn't know at the time that was going to happen, but it did. And looking back on it, I was really happy about that. But during the times that we were at Illinois, I think it became very important for me to experience something as difficult as dealing with the weather, also dealing with the university and the rules and regulations that didn't apply at Fullerton, where we had first say in the time of our players, you know, that they could practice for long periods of time and so on. At Illinois, they already had time limits, and there were all kinds of rules and regulations connected to the academic side of it. Getting to know all of that, I think, was very important for me to be able to handle the Texas environment. Mm-hmm. So all in all, you know, then as life would have it, the president that went in was out within 3 years. Apparently there were some other decisions that weren't popular. I certainly was not the reason. Don't misunderstand me.
Sure.
But then Larry Koschel, who was at Fullerton, was moved away to take the Oklahoma job. It just became a coincidence. I, at that time, was with Jim Morris as an assistant on the USA team. And we were traveling, and Fullerton got in touch with me, and they promised that we would build a stadium. And we did. That was the good news. We built the stadium.
Sure.
However, 2 years we had to play in a city recreation park.
Right back where you started.
Yeah. Well, that's the Fullerton way.
Sure.
One step forward and two steps back. You know, it's a dance routine.
Yeah.
Dancing with the commoners, you know, not with the stars.
Sure.
So anyway, I didn't like the weather. I got fooled by the weather, and that was laughable. Let me tell you about, I like to cook. You probably know that.
Yes. Yep.
And so let me explain something about charcoal. When you throw lighter fluid on it, and you strike a match, and you're going to barbecue, and it's 7 below 0, the charcoal explodes, and sparks fly.
You found that out firsthand.
Yeah, I found it out. I didn't read about it.
Right.
And I didn't look it
I
up
lived
online.
It.
No, I lived it.
That's great.
There we go. But anyway, it was really an exciting time, and I met some wonderful people, and we had really good teams. The two teams I was there for 3 years. We won two Big Ten championships and just missed going to the College World Series. And I think it gave me a much broader scope of appreciation for our game at the university level, and that we should respect the industry as an industry and not lean on Major League Baseball, but be the industry that we are, be independent as we can be, and at the same time recognize that without Major League Baseball, there wouldn't be the emphasis or the quality of college baseball that exists. But I think that for so many years in the early going, everything was, well, will Major League Baseball do that for us? Let's do it for ourselves.
Sure.
You know, we've got it, and we've moved toward that position much more so now.
All right, Coach, we're going to put a bow on this interview. I got one more question for you, and I think I know it's going to be tough because you are very humble in a lot of different regards, but you know, your contributions to the game, and we can go through this, are just boundless. And you've influenced countless players and coaches. And whether you see this, I know you do, the ones that directly apply to being around you and you influence them that way, but you've also influenced people from afar. And I'm just wondering, and I think our coaches would be well served to hear this from you. What are you most proud of as you reflect back on your career in the game and your impact on the game? What are you most proud of? What do you sleep well at night knowing that you've accomplished throughout your time in college baseball?
I don't know. I've never thought about that.
There you go. Yep.
I.
We ask the tough questions here at the ABCA. No.
Yeah, well, you know, you're dealing with a high D student from a state university, you know. I wasn't.
See, I had expectations.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm friends with Kevin Costner, so
yep.
I love this comment. After I switched jobs at the University of Texas recently, he says, well, Augie, in your farewell speech, he says, make sure and explain to them clearly. He says that you are so very proud to have been the coach at a school that you didn't have the grades to attend.
I really made it, guys.
Yeah.
Shoot.
So I guess whatever contributions that we've made and whatever contributions we can make in the future, quite frankly,
sure,
are totally unconditional. And I hope that whatever part I can play in the betterment of college baseball and University of Texas and Cal State Fullerton and the people that I haven't thought about it the way we're talking about it,
mm-hmm.
but I am extremely thankful for people like yourself and other people that enrich my life just by your perception of me, the way you treat me, the way you respect me, speaks volumes for all of the people that are a part of me. Because when you work in a team environment all your life, there is no question about the following. You take on from others
mm-hmm.
parts of what you admire, and what you become is a product of many, many people. And even though Trump doesn't know this, it is about someone else other than yourself.
Sure.
So I'm just thankful for all of that. Mm.
Coach, I could thank you 1,000 times over, but you know, in setting this up, we've had some great conversations. I'm so glad we were able to get this on record, because I think this is going to be a highly received interview that we had a chance to sit down and get you on record and spend some time with you, Augie. So I really do. I appreciate your time. We appreciate what you've done for the game of baseball, and certainly thankful that you took time out of your day to sit down with us. So we appreciate it. We look forward to staying in touch with you, my man. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You guys did a great job. And remember, it's all in the editing.
100%. Augie, you're the best, man. Thank you so much.
Take
man.
Care, man.
Have
you
a great night.
You as well.
And boom, period, exclamation point, all of it. Wow, just an awesome opportunity to welcome in Augie Garrido to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast and talk through his storied career in our game. You may not have had enough paper or even enough ink in your pen for all the takeaways from the show. Love the behind-the-scenes glimpse into the early days and the process of building one of the most prominent programs in all of college baseball, talking about Cal State Fullerton. But also for the coaches who are listening in, we hope you didn't miss the invaluable viewpoint on the game itself from one of the true living legends in our sport. We can choose to never lose ever again. It's a game of opportunity. I mean, just some of the powerful words and messages from Coach Augie Garrido that were inside this episode. So thanks again, Augie, for the time. We appreciate you being so giving to our listeners and to the game, for that matter. I told them, coaches, before we got rolling, time did not matter on this one. I'm going to keep asking questions as long as he keeps answering them. And what a blessing to have this episode, this content, and have Coach Garrido on the show for our listeners. As always, another huge thanks to AstroTurf for their sponsorship of our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. If you're interested in learning more about how AstroTurf can help take your facility to brand new levels, like they have for over 200 fields around the country, head over to AstroTurf.com. That's AstroTurf.com. Talk to the experts in the turf industry on how they have stayed ahead of the curve for almost 50 years. Now remember, guys, this podcast is for you. These are perfect for the car rides or the bus trips, the workouts. Maybe you're just mowing some grass on the field. Anywhere and anywhere that fits, they're there for you to connect with some of the very best baseball minds in our game. So here's how you stay updated on every episode that we're releasing. Number one, head over to iTunes or Google Play, subscribe to our show on your iPhone or your Android device. This is a no-brainer. They show up on your phone each Tuesday, a new show is released. It's right there waiting for you when you're ready and on the move. Number two, stay plugged into our website, abca.org. If you click on the resources tab at the top, Calls from the Clubhouse podcast link will be right there waiting for you. You can see all the terrific content and guests we've had. Click on the one specifically you want to hear that day. And number three, just give us a follow on Twitter at ABCA1945. We always announce the release of our show, plus we pull some of the very best quotes from that show, put out some quote images throughout the week, links to hear it. Guys, it's right there for you at ABCA1945 on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, we'd love to have you and all of your coaching buddies join us on our next hashtag ABCA chat coming up on Monday night, April 17th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
So what is it? Hashtag ABCA Chat, you ask? It's a platform that allows our coaches from around the world to connect with one another. We're sharing coaching information while networking, connecting with each other. It's all in the spirit of growing our coaches' knowledge, developing ourselves professionally. It's very simple, guys. ABCA poses questions to the coaches. The coaches post their answers or their information. The retweet and like buttons are going crazy as we all get an opportunity to see what else is being taught out there in our game. We hear what other great coaches are thinking and teaching, and maybe even challenging what we're doing with our players. It's an awesome time, guys. Again, Monday, April 17th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We hope to see you check in on our next hashtag ABCA Chat. Also, again, make sure you're following us on there at ABCA1945. We try to put membership information, messages from some of our sponsors, coaching articles and insight, plus our podcast information. So we want to make sure you're on there with us. Also, you can find me on there as well, at Coach Sheets 3. You can also reach me directly by email, Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. Do us a favor. If you love this show, or is there a specific line or quote that hits you hard, tweet at us. I can almost guarantee you a retweet on there, but we just love hearing from you guys. Shoot us a tweet, a message, an email. It's always a pleasure to connect with our listeners, but even more rewarding to hear how this content and our association are positively enhancing you. Help us spread the word about our show. Make sure you're retweeting our podcast link or the quote images, all of it. These aren't just for coaches, guys. These are for the players that follow you, the parents that are on your feed, baseball fans, enthusiasts everywhere, and we appreciate your help in spreading the great word. Lastly, this is the podcast for the American Baseball Coaches Association and the over 8,000 coaches worldwide that we represent. We hope that if you're listening to the show, you've already joined our baseball coaches fraternity, but if not, head over to abca.org, check out our extensive membership benefits, learn about all the great things we're doing for our coaches and for our game. And as always, thank you for listening in and staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. We got another great episode coming at you next week. But until then, keep growing, keep developing. We wish you and your club the very best. And thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.